the nonlinear physics of beam plasma systems. So this is work that I've been continuing to do with the large collaboration, Avery, Astrid, Christoph Frommer, Ewald Porcher, and Mohal Chalabi. Okay, so I'll give a brief, start with a brief outline of my talk. Christoph already talked about this morning, followed by Brett, but I'll just give maybe have one or two slides on it. Basically, a review of the linear instability, most notably the oblique instability, and basically focus much more on the intuitive picture, which has been basically stated already by Christoph. All right, and I'll basically state some of the current numerical understanding of the oblique instability, especially in respect to basically work by Lorenzo Soroni and Dimitrios Gaianos, and also more recent work by Mohal Chalabi. And basically talk briefly about some of the analytic approaches to nonlinear plasma physics that have existed in the literature, most notably quasi-linear theory, which is basically wave-background interaction, and then wave-particle interaction, wave-wave interaction, and finally some discussion briefly on strong turbulence effects, and I'll close with a short summary slide. Okay, so to begin, I'm going to basically just look again at the oblique instability as a very intuitive picture of how this works. So basically, oblique instability is mediated by an overstable Langmuir wave. What's a Langmuir wave? Langmuir wave is the electrostatic equivalent of a sound wave, where basically in sound waves, density perturbations are mediated by pressure fluctuations, right? Whereas basically in a Langmuir wave, there are electric field, there are charge perturbations mediated by basically electrostatic interactions, right? So that means basically like all waves, they have a K vector and associated basically a frequency omega. So for that, they all have a characteristic phase velocity omega over C or omega over K. Right? And basically moved in the reference frame of such a wave, basically in the phase velocity, what you see basically is that the electric field points one way, then the other way, then one way again. Right? Now, if you have an electron or positron which moves at some angle obliquely to the k vector of this wave, what will happen is that basically certain particles will be moving faster than the wave, certain particles will move slightly slower than the wave. Like these particles were moving roughly about the same velocity as the wave, will resonantly exchange energy with the wave, right? Okay, and typically this oblique instability is a lot more powerful, as mentioned earlier this morning, for generating instability, because deflecting the charged particles directionality is far, far easier than trying to change their straight line velocity, as would be the case for the beam plasma instability, right? Okay, all right, so in any case, basically, what happens is that depending on the distribution function of the particles, namely if there are more particles exchanging energy with the wave, then basically what you have is an instability in the wave. If there are more particles basically sapping energy from the wave, then you have basically what's called a traditional Landau damping. Okay. In any case, basically the oblique instability, as mentioned by Antoine, is basically just a generalization of the two classical instabilities which have dominated the field of astrophysics up to now, basically named the two-stream instability and the Weibull instability. And these basically have to do with characteristic wave vector with respect to basically the beam propagation direction. So when in the direction of the beam, basically you have the two-stream instability. In perpendicular beam, you have the Weibull instability. And as Antoine mentioned already this morning, the real world is not just basically divided into those who are in parallel and those who are perpendicular, but somewhere in between. And in general, basically the greatest growth for ultra-relativistic beams, all right, ultra-relativistic tenuous beams, basically with a small beam fraction relative background, and for very high Lorentz factor, is the typical oblique instability. All right, so that basically summarizes a lot of the talks that we said this morning. Now, the effect of this on these TV pair beams is quite pronounced. Right. If you calculate the growth rate of the instability versus inverse Compton scattering, if you take what we call the self-consistent oblique instability, this basically beats this inverse Compton upscattering of the CMB usually by about two orders of magnitude or so. Right. And so basically this will suppress a lot of the GV emission that people have alluded to as basically being suppressed by magnetic fields, basically from primordial by formal primordial fields. Right? Now, The problem with this is that all this stuff is relies on basically our understanding of the linear instability, right? And at the in the most basic understand how this works, typically the only thing you can calculate initially is just a linear instability, right? So you have to rely a little bit on basically what you think the nonlinear instability look like, right? And for that, we basically rely on basically a early PIC simulation done by Brett and his collaborators, right? Where what they did is they basically took a three-dimensional PIC simulation of a beam of hot electrons, right? Basically inspired by inertial confinement fusion studies, right, moving through electron-positron plasma. Right? Now, the density ratio is much more modest than compared to basically what we have in the intergalactic medium. In the intergalactic medium, we have basically a density ratio of 10 to the minus 18, right, and basically a gamma factor of 10 to the 6. What they will simulate is basically a density ratio of 0.1 and basically a gamma of around 3 or 5 or so. Okay, but the understanding you can get from these simulations was actually quite excellent. All right, so what you found was that basically they were initially starting in a regime where the oblique instability is dominant. Right, and so what happens is that you can see that this in the plot of basically density in the plot of the charge perturbations, you can see that the charge perturbations are oblique relative to the beam direction. That's why the oblique instability gets its name from, right? But what you can see is that as time goes on, right, that these density perturbations start to move basically in the perpendicular to the beam, which basically says that what's happening is that you're moving from a regime where the oblique instability is dominant to where the beam plasma or two-stream instability is dominant, right? And basically, as Antoine mentioned this morning, the reason why this happens, at least in their understanding of it, was that basically the seeds of the destruction of instability is in the instability itself, right? Basically, what happens is that the oblique instability causes a change in the background such that it no longer becomes the dominant mole, but there's still some free energy available. And so basically what happens at that point is the beam plasma instability takes over, right? If you wait yet longer still, the seeds for destruction of the beam plasma are there already in the beam plasma instability itself. And so what happens eventually is that basically it saturates, and what you have left, because given the so you still have some anisotropy in the system, is that you have the Weibull instability, okay? So this is a very nice picture of trying to understand it. And so the way to think about it in terms of basically our initial understanding of this, of the physics of the system, was that basically what you're doing is you're moving from regime to regime, right? And as you move out that regime, basically you change your background or your beam background enough such that you are suppressing that initial instability, right? Now, in Brett's case, all right, what they were looking at is basically where like the oblique instability is marginally like more prominent than, let's say, the beam plasma or the Weibull instability, right? And so in that case, basically what happens is that you have to move your background or move your beam distribution such that it basically kills the oblique instability. And in the case of these simulations, what they found was that basically 30% of the total energy was dumped into the background heating of the plasma before the end of the simulation, right? Basically, you just had to stop it at some point, okay? And so in this case, 30% of this 30%, 20% total, all right, was basically dumped, basically going from here to here, okay? Okay, so what that means is that basically I had to move my distribution function out of that regime, all right? But in the TV case, for TV blazars, we're much, much further deeper into that regime. So it basically, as a leap of faith, leap of insight, depending on how you look at it, right? We're assuming that in order to move that amount of basically distribution function, right, to suppress the oblique instability, we have to basically move about order unity of that energy, right? So initially we thought that fine, the oblique instability or basically the two-stream instability, whatever instability we have to worry about. Basically, we'll basically change the beam until basically an order one of the energy gets dumped into the background plasma as heat. All right. Now, so this is great until basically this paper came out, Cerrone and Gaiano, 2013. Now, what they did was actually like the next logical step, which is that like you have a tool, all right, a hammer. You basically use the hammer stuff, right? And what they did was they hammered us with it. Okay. So what they did was they basically took Tristan, all right, to look at the instability in two dimensions and in one dimension, right? Right. At a much higher Lorentz factor, so this is basically Lorentz factors anywhere from 100 to about 1,000 or so, and basically with beam to background plasma ratios about 1% to about 0.1%. Right. And what they argue was that basically if you basically just run the simulation till the end, all right, what you end up getting is a maximal, you get about 10% of the beam energy gets converted to heat, okay, maximal, right? But this is that for the so coldest case that's possible, basically. So this is the beam temperature of 10 to the minus 6 of relative to the MEC squared, all right? Okay, and as you increase the beam temperature, all right, what will happen is that like, you might expect the linear instability to get less powerful, et cetera, et cetera. But what they also found was that basically saturation gets lower and lower and lower and lower, right? So basically about a beam temperature of 0.3, they basically got something about 1% or so, right? Okay, now the expectation, right, in the TV case was that TB in their units will be about order unity or so.
Yep. What is the unit of temperature?
This is relative to MEC squared. All right, so basically relative to the background, relative to the particles, it's a relativistic non-dimensional unit, okay? Right. So what they also basically show, I didn't show this basically either, is that this conversion is also expected to be lower, right, for more tenuous and more relativistic beams. So basically where they're able to probe, okay, it will actually get worse and worse basically as you approach toward TEV beams. Right? So this was actually sort of depressing. So the best we can get was basically 10%. At worst, basically, it might just be essentially zero. Okay. Now, what can we do about this? So one thing we can do is we can try to do quote-unquote better numerical simulations. So basically, Mohammed will talk about this later. He's constructed a higher order code called Maxwell. I believe that's the name right now, right? Okay, which has far superior energy conservation. So in their initial case here, when Lorenzo and Gaillons basically did the study, what they argued was that their energy conservation is 1%, right? And of course, basically, it's not really clear 1% of what, all right? It's like relative to the protons, relative to the background beam, relative to the total thermal energy, it was not clear, okay? And so they argued, well, it's 1%, all right? And this conversion is higher by a factor of 10, and so we can trust these results. Okay, so in Mohammed's case, this is his energy conversion, all right, relative to the initial beam energy, all right, and it's 10 to the minus 6. Okay, so this is far superior energy conservation, mainly due to the fact that he's able to understand how to map the electric fields to the different particle positions a lot better. Okay, and in this case, what's also interesting about this, right, is that this is basically the change in the kinetic energy of the beam as a function of basically time, right? And in this case, what he gets is basically near order unity conversion of energy to heat, right? Okay, so this is significantly better. Now the problem is this is one dimension, but if you compare it to the one dimensional case that Lorenzo and Gaillons basically show, this is at least a factor of 3 better than what they found.
Right. This is the same parameters?
Yes, the same parameters. Right.
What is Lorentz factor in the distribution?
What is what?
The Lorentz factor in the
distribution. This Lorentz factor, was it 100 or something? 100, yeah.
In the distribution? In the modesty.
Yeah.
So, sorry, in the Lorenzo case, when they do one dimension, how much of the beam energy?
About 30% or so, 30%.
They simulate much smaller.
Yeah.
Time range because they lose energy in the mixture.
Now, there are other ways of doing this, basically, other than doing better and better numerics. So that's clearly one way of doing it, right? So another method, basically, is to understand that in the case of the TV beams, right, that we can try to do analytic methods via perturbation theory. And the reason why is that, basically, you're looking at very small fluctuations relative to whatever background you're looking at. So you can consider, basically, expanding relative to the energy beam relative to the thermal energy of the entire bath, right? This is much, much smaller. So what that implies is the wave amplitude is typically pretty small, OK? Okay, I'm glossing over that because basically that's not exactly the way you do perturbation theory. You have to understand basically what really truly is a small parameter trying to do, right? But nevertheless, you can just try to push it along, right? And also another nice thing about basically analytic method is that you can turn off and on various different pieces of physics to try to basically resolve basically what are the most important pieces of physics that you need to understand on the numerical level, right? But you can also compare basically with numerical results. Now, when we saturate these waves in basically nonlinear theory, there are several different ways they saturate, but they all basically come back to the same fundamental idea, right? There's quasi-linear theory, weak wave-wave coupling, wave-particle coupling, and finally, strong turbulence. Well, strong turbulence is a totally different effect, but like most, the first three are basically relatively the same sort of idea as each other, okay? So let's basically start with the most dominant idea, which is occurs in most fields of astrophysics in terms of understanding how these things saturate, which is quasi-linear theory. Okay, so in quasi-linear theory, the effect of the instability basically is to change the background until they are no longer unstable. Right. So the way it works is basically if you basically think of an electrostatic system, you start with a Vlasov equation. So this is this equation for the distribution, right? Subject to basically the change of the distribution's momenta. Okay. And basically this is Coulomb equation, basically. Right. So let's consider perturbations of such a form. You basically have basically break a distribution function into a background and a basically delta. And you what you end up getting is that if you have the first order effect, right, what you get is you end up getting basically a perturbed Vlasov equation, perturbed Coulomb equation, and in essence, basically a dispersion relation at the very end, right? And this dispersion relation basically relates basically omega relative to the k, basically based on what is happening with the distribution of the background. Okay, now quasi-linear theory takes this one step further, right? So this just tells you what the unstable modes are, right? So you basically find out what omega as a function of k would need to be, okay? Now, what you do from quasi-linear theory, you take it one step further, you look at this equation again, imagine this is linear, right? Now, let's imagine now the background is no longer just some thick fat, some statically fixed thing, but varies as a function of time. Okay? And this function of time is a slow function compared to the wave background mode, right? Which is e to the I exponent omega k, right? Now, when you do that, right, you plug this into this equation right here, right? What happens is that this thing is still assumed to be homogeneous, so this term goes away, right? But you have a very weak term right here, which must be balanced by something over here, right? Now, so what you do in that case is basically, let's assume you put modes in here. If you put modes in here, what happens is that the lowest order you can close it is basically at second order, where you have an e to the minus ik omega t plus e to I omega t, so they cancel each other out, and then you have a slow growth rate basically that relates here, right? And hidden here basically is actually the background via the original dispersion relationship. Whoops. Okay. In any case, basically reduce this equation into a simple diffusion equation in momentum space, right? And that's actually a fairly easy thing to understand. Basically, what happens is that when you have instability, right, it depends on the steepness of the momentum distribution, of the distribution function in momentum space. And what you want to do is you want to smooth the thing out as a result of this instability. Right? Okay, and this diffusion coefficient here depends on basically delta E square, right? So it depends on the amplitude of the wave, right? And so what happens in quasi-linear theory is that this thing starts to basically change as a function of time. The modes tend to grow basically on some instability time scale. And what happens is that the most this thing starts to get suppressed when the background is changing on the same time scale as basically the original mode, okay? All right, so this is the way that we try to understand a lot of the physics in terms of basically plasma physics and shock theory especially. So this is basically a result which I did with Ahrens and Spakovsky many, many years ago. This was not done for basically the TEV blazer case, but it's basically done for internal shocks and gamma ray bursts, right? So what you have in this case is basically equal density shells colliding with each other, which basically whose strongest mole in this case is the Y-bone stability. And you can see the Y-bone stability growing pretty rapidly here. What you see is basically these long filamentary structures whose separation is roughly something like one over the plasma skin, well, whose separation is basically roughly the plasma skin depth. Right, so you can basically see that in this case, the magnetic field energy grows rapidly, all right? So basically the delta B square is growing rapidly until they basically violently change the distribution function such that it's much, much more thermalized, right? And so toward the end of it, basically just thermalizes this thing. You do have no longer any instability whatsoever, right? And so this is basically a way of understanding GRB shocks, right? But nevertheless, it illustrates the general point. Basically, you have instability which is growing as a function of time. It gets to a certain large amplitude. At that basically point, what happens is you have like violent mixing of this, right? Which you can sort of understand as a strong diffusion coefficient, basically wiping out the initial anisotropy. Okay, now. That's not the only way that this thing can suppress. And generally, when we think about quasi-linear theory, the reason why we think about it is that we look at very, very strong systems where the background is modified very, very rapidly. Okay? But this is not the only way it can happen, basically. You can also look at wave-particle interactions, which are not just wave-background interactions, right? So the way this works is that basically, again, you take the Vlasov equation, right? And in this case, basically, instead of thinking that the waves are just rapidly growing as some function of time, all right? That what you can think of is basically, let's imagine that there's like a scaling of this equation, which breaks into basically exponential, which makes it a wave part, and something which is much more secular. Now, in this secular part is contained basically the linear growth rate, okay, in principle, right? But you can also look at basically other effects on the secular part, right? Namely due to wave particle interactions. So you, if you basically perturb the equation, you could write an equation that looks like this. And the one thing you'll note that's slightly different here is that this is a K prime, okay? And rather than a K prime here, you also have a K here, right? So this allows you to couple basically waves of different K vectors and different omegas, right? Now, if you do this, right, the only time this will work is that basically you can have a coupling between the two, all right? So you get some small beat wave, right? But if you calculate what the beat wave is, this has a very, very small phase velocity. Relatively speaking, V phase is roughly about the speed of light or so, and basically, but this is expressed by this thermal velocity of electron over the speed of light squared, okay? So this is only resonant, right, with very slow particles, basically. So in principle, basically, if you write it, it's basically V electrons times VE over V phase, right? So the only particles which are that slow, or even slower than electrons, are basically ions, right? And so this forms the basis of what's called nonlinear Landau damping, though it has nothing in principle to do with Landau damping, right? Okay, so I'm going to basically illustrate an intuitive picture of how this works. So imagine, again, I have a laminar wave, right? So electric field basically points one way, then the other, and back again. And I have basically an electron and a proton basically sitting there, all right? Now, when I apply the electric field here, what happens is that both particles will accelerate, okay? But the electrons, being much lighter but feeling the same force, will accelerate much more rapidly. Right? And because of that, it will lead to a separation in charge between the protons and electrons. Right? This, in turn, leads to an induced electric field that points in the opposite direction as the initial accelerating field. Right? And basically, what happens is that this induced electric field is going to be oscillating because of the fact that I'm also driving it with basically the Langmuir wave. And so this induced electric field, basically by oscillation, will in turn generate a scattered wave, right? And that's basically the simple picture of how nonlinear Landau damping works. Okay. Now, the order of magnitude estimate, like which is done by Minati and Eli, argue that this interaction, nonlinear Landau damping, basically limits the growth of instability very, very small value, right? So what you can do is you basically look up the old Russian literature. This is basically the equation for the waves in nonlinear Landau damping. There's two parts. This is the growth part, okay? The two gammas, because basically the unstable part goes like gamma. The energy is basically the wave squared, so it's two gamma, right? And so this is basically some like nastiness, which I don't care to explain, okay? All right, so in any case, basically what you can show, is that the time scale scales like this, basically. It scales like the wave frequency divided by what is essentially basically the some factor of the kinetic energy of the electrons, right? Okay, so if you balance this against the growth rate, right, which basically we discussed about this morning, what you end up getting is that the wave energy relative to the beam energy here is exceedingly small, basically 3 × 10⁻⁵. And so this argument was made to say that basically as a result of this, you saturate at extraordinarily low level. Okay, now, one thing that we did was that we tried to say, okay, so this is bad news, all right? So the question is basically, what really happens in real life, right? So what we did was that we did basically the simple calculation, which is that you take this equation, right? And we basically plug it into a computer, right? Basically solving over many, many different k's on a logarithmic scale, right? And so what we can find is the following, basically, all right? So you can solve for a number of moles, logarithmic space for n equals 300 moles or 1,000 moles, basically it doesn't matter, it's totally converged, right? And you can basically plot what the wave energy is as a function of the beam energy, as a function of the growth time, right? And so what happens initially is that you have very, very, very rapid growth, right? Okay? And the first thing is it starts to level off. So the first thing is that life is good because it's above the 3 × 10⁻⁵ that your order of magnitude estimate calculates, right? And then it basically turns over and grows at a very, very slow rate, right? So the saturation happens at 1% of beam energy. So this is better than what they estimate, but still not great, okay? But the wave continues to grow at basically a rate which is slower than the initial growth rate, but still growing, right? Okay, in any case, this, even at this rate, this is sufficient to allow plasma instabilities to overcome inverse Compton scattering for many cases, if not most cases. All right, so let's try and understand basically what happens, like why does this continue to grow? Like why is the order of magnitude estimate of 3 × 10⁻⁵ wrong? Okay, well, so what you can do, what I've plotted here is basically a plot of the spectrum at different times, basically. So this might be some initial time, all right? So what you have here is that you have the unstable mole growing, basically, and what happens is that, so this is the initially unstable mole, it grows until it reaches a certain point and starts basically dumping energy into the long wavelength mode, right? So one thing that I forgot to mention is that when you look at nonlinear Landau damping, all right, what you end up getting is you scatter from 1K to another K. And when you do that, you basically have to resonantly couple with some ion. But in doing so, you're basically exchanging some momentum with the ion. And so what happens is that you always go to lower and lower K, right? And so that's what's happening here. Basically, what's happening is that these modes are unstable. It starts basically dumping energy into low K mode. These start to grow and starts to eat away basically a lot of the low K, a lot of the higher K stuff, right? Okay? But not all the high K stuff. So in fact, if you look very closely at this equation here, it has exponential suppression, all right, for sufficiently high changes in delta K. And so that basically, you can calculate for what K does this suppression start to become important. And basically, for basically Ks below 20 omega Ps over C, or basically, or inversely, for Ks above 20 omega Ps over C, then you don't have that suppression. So basically what happens here is that these really, really high K modes can continue to dump energy to the very, very low K mode. Now, this is a fairly narrow region, right? Because it's limited at the highest K by the fact that you have linear Landau damping happening. And so that linear Landau damping will basically kill above this point. But in between, you still have some energy which can basically continuously dump energy into lower K mode, right? Okay? And in any case, if you look at it, basically this continues to grow, right? In the absence of anything happened to low K modes, basically to order unity. Okay, now this might have a different, might have effects at different redshifts and at different, basically for different energies. So namely, as you go toward redshift one, basically what happens is that the beam to background ratio improves, that's good, okay? Or basically if you move toward higher and higher energy, basically L-ISO blazer, your beam to background energy also improves, right? So in any case, this is basically a plot for basically L of 45 ergs per second. So this is basically one right here. This is basically where nonlinear Landau damping is equal to basically inverse Compton scattering. This is one for 10 to the 45 ergs per second. And what you can see, basically, for a large region in parameter space, basically what happens is that the nonlinear Landau damping, I mean, is not a significant effect on the growth rate of the on the suppression of these TeV blazers, right? Okay. Okay, so there are other interactions that one can talk about, all right? So basically, there's also wave-wave interaction as well. Unstable waves can also couple via wave-wave interaction. Again, it's the same philosophy. You write down the Perturbed-Vlasov equations, right? In this case, now instead of basically a K and a K prime, you basically have, I didn't write this correctly, a K double prime, a K prime, and a K, all right? And so basically subject to conditions of basically omega double prime is equal to omega prime plus or minus omega, K double prime is equal to K prime plus or minus K. And again, you get a very slow beat wave, right? But now rather than beating against basically ions, you beat against other waves. And the only waves which are very, very slow like this are slow ion sound waves. Right. In principle, you can also basically beat against other Langmuir waves, but the lowest order basically perturbation you can have is a formal coupling in that case, which is a lot more, should be smaller than basically ion sound waves. Right. This can be numerically solved relative to the wave particle interactions, but this has not been done yet. Okay. So finally, I want to close with some discussion of some of the strong turbulence effects that might happen. Right? So the strongest turbulence effects that I know about, and Reinhardt can correct me later, is the modulation instability. Okay? And the idea behind it is actually quite nice, and I didn't realize how universal this phenomenon was until I started studying it. So basically, this is best illustrated with surface gravity water waves, but it's also, in essence, the same as for nonlinear steeping of sound waves, right? So what happens is this is the surface gravity water wave extended to higher order. I forget what A is, but anyway, in any case, basically, the GK is the normal, basically, non-dispersive surface gravity water wave, right? There's a correction to this, basically, which most people ignore, but you really...
GK is dispersive.
Yes. GK is dispersive. But this is the normal, yes, right. Okay. Right, the A is the amplitude, right? So what happens is that when you just have a wave of a single frequency, what happens is that you can have a correction basically on the group velocity of the wave, depending on the amplitude of the wave that you're looking at, right? So what happens is that the group velocity increases toward increasing amplitude and decreases toward decreasing amplitude. And so what happens is you end up getting a concentration of waves, right, in regions of high amplitude, right? And what happens is they basically can steepen and steepen until they start to break. And so this is an experiment done by Benjamin in 1967. So what they did was very simple. You have like a big water tank and a chopper, okay? And the chopper basically creates waves of a single frequency and a single amplitude, right? And you basically just look at this wave pattern as it flows down this long tank, right? At 60 meters, it looks nice and neat. By 120 meters, you can see basically that there is an envelope that's developing in this wave. And what happens is that if you keep waiting longer and longer, what happens is that these waves start to break up and to move into like smaller high K modes, right? In any case, basically, in the case of the plasmas, what happens is that regions of high wave intensity lead to an evacuation of charge density, of background charge density. Right? And so basically, this also leads to increasing amplitude as well. Right? And the condition for instability is that basically the wave amplitude relative to the background thermal energy has to be much, much larger than K times basically the plasma skin depth. right? Or the divide length, sorry, divide length, right? Okay, and so what that basically gives you for the case of basically the long wavelength nonlinear Landau damped waves that I got, which is something like k of minus 2 or so, right? It's basically this amplitude, 2 times 10 to the minus 10, right? Okay, and basically it scales with wave number of the long wavelength modes, right? Now, what's interesting is that if you take that 0.1% of the beam energy that was basically initially saturated, all right, you basically 1%, 0.1% doesn't really matter, what you end up getting is that basically this value is already 10 to the minus 9, okay? So when you look at this mode here, right, this is already more than enough to fulfill the requirement for the modulation stability, right? And so what will happen is that we follow the logic of what happens to the modulation stability. In the standard case, what happens is that these big waves will start to break, form into small high K modes, which have a random phase, which in essence can basically lead to basically turbulent heating of the background plasma. Okay, so I'm gonna close the summary now, all right? Linear oblique instability dominates over the inverse Compton for cooling the pair beams, right? But this is not enough, right? You really need to understand what the nonlinear evolution and saturation instability has to be, right? Initially, there was some preliminary evidence for optimism, namely basically Brett's initial pick simulations, and later some evidence for pessimism, namely basically the simulations by Cerrone and Gaianos, right? The current state of the art suggests that nonlinear physics do not sufficiently suppress the instability. And there's two lines of evidence for this. First is numerical evidence, which Mohamed Chalabi will talk about, I think, tomorrow. And there's some analytic evidence based on the nonlinear Landau damping, which doesn't have any of the other physics of wave-wave coupling and strong turbulence that also may be important, right? So the suppression due to nonlinear Landau may be significant for some systems at certain redshifts, namely a very high redshift and closer to redshift 1 for sufficiently weak blazars, right? There's an unknown effect of wave-wave coupling, which is something we have not studied yet, right? But the strong turbulent effects of modulation still may lead to the background thermalization of the background electrons, and this may be an important effect that we need to discuss, especially in context of the nonlinear Landau damped systems.
Thanks a lot, Philip. Questions?
Yeah, I had a question regarding your quasi-linear formalism a few slides ago.
Right, yeah.
From what I saw, your formalism wouldn't let you follow the system if it goes a Weibull unstable or something like this, because it was purely electrostatic.
Yes, that's
so
right.
Isn't it a bit cavate or?
A bit what?
Cavate.
Cavalier. It would be a cavalier. So there's several responses to this, right? So the thing is, like I said, you can always turn on and off different pieces of physics, right? So the proper way of doing it, and this is stuff that's done by most notably in the solar physics community by Peter Yoon, all right, is that you turn on all the pieces of systems, right? Which implies that you also need to have a linear solver for arbitrary distribution function, right? So this is outside of our powers right now. So one thing to do is basically look at each one of these different nonlinear damping methods and then check post facto that they do not affect the background to a sufficient degree that suppresses the linear instability at that point.
Yeah, I think just a comment on this wave coupling. I think the ion sound wave will only exist if you have a very different electron and proton temperatures, which does not seem to be the case.
Oh, is that right?
At least as a weakly damped wave. Yeah.
As a weakly damped wave. All right. Okay. In that case, then formal. I'm a little surprised. Then formal coupling is the only way of doing it. In that case. All right. Okay. Well.
So I have a picture in mind. Tell me what's wrong with it. So if I shoot a bullet in the air and it's moving supersonically, then the way it dissipates its energy is by, I guess, the shock waves.
Yes.
Because it's going supersonic. So I guess there would be a way to estimate how much energy is lost per unit time
right.
by probably the size of it and then the
yep.
The speed of sound, basically.
Right, yeah.
So why isn't it the same in your case? It's basically a bullet that's going to the IGM and you say to produce a shockwave and then...
Okay, so our initial estimate is really that estimate. It's like it's making the argument that like, hey, you have this bullet, okay? You can ask 100% of the energy goes into the IGM, right? And then you can basically figure out the rest, right? The problem is like this is a detail problem now, right? The problem is that like suppose for instance that that it takes infinitely long for it to lose that energy via this particular wave.
You can't, if there is a bullet that is in fact is a bullet that's going through IGM, you can't calculate how much energy is lost in generating the shockwave, isn't it?
No, but it's not a shockwave, that's the thing. It's not a shockwave.
It's a kinetic effect. It's
yeah.
a hydrodynamic
effect. Collision
yeah.
of shock.
Collision.
Yeah.
It's a collision of shock,
yeah.
but it's still.
But it's not, yeah.
It is a way too low to use hydrodynamics.
Yeah.
Okay, you're saying it's not a high.
So the problem is that like first of all the waves you're generating is in a linear regime. Like the shockwave you have is nonlinear already. So that's
yeah.
So life is simple in that case, right? Because you say that like, okay, fine, I've nonlinear, I don't understand anything anyway, but I know the strong effect, right? So therefore it's gotta be 100, right? Okay. In this case it's all in a linear regime, you could in principle calculate everything. And the problem is that like what is the next order physics?
But that's what I mean, because it seems to me that it must be an inherently nonlinear problem because it's supersonic, so it must be shockwave. So then why do you try
no,
to
there, so linear? So I'm not sure what you mean by supersonic, all right? Because the problem is that in terms of the Langmuir wave, they in principle have any phase speed you want, all right? So they can actually be superluminal. So they're actually not, you actually are not quote unquote supersonic or supersonic relative to these background Langmuir waves.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, but you agree that ultimately this is going to be turned into sound waves, right? Because I mean,
like ultimately everything turned into sound waves. The problem is I'm competing against another process, which is inverse Compton scattering.
Sure.
Right, so that's the thing. So the question is basically how much time do I have? So if it was not for inverse Compton scattering, I wouldn't care. All right, but the problem is I'm competing against something else, some other physics in the problem, which is also tied in this race. And initially, at least on a linear level, like I was winning the race, but now on a nonlinear level, it's not clear whether or not the race is going to be won, right?
I think with this inverse Compton, you have to be a little bit more careful. You're comparing with the growth time of the instability.
Yes.
What you really should compare with is with the back reaction time in your particle distribution function.
Right.
Which is significantly longer than the your shortest growth time. And also if the beam pairs are beamed,
yep.
the inverse Compton time scale is even affect the gamma squared is shorter than what you assume.
So you're
running and you run the beam distribution function
yeah.
through the microwave background gradient.
Right.
If you go to the rest frame, the energy density is an
right.
atmospheric
yeah, so
that might even make the inverse Compton time scale very short.
Right. So
I think the problem with
yeah.
inverse Compton and overproducing the GeV flux is still
right.
Existed.
Yes. Yeah. So whenever we do this calculation, we're always moving into the laboratory frame. All right,
yeah.
of our laboratory thing, and we're watching the beam go
then
by.
Then we have to take into account that
yeah.
electrons are not isotropic. They are
yes.
anisotropic,
yeah.
whereas all these standard inverse Compton yields from Blumenthal
right, right,
and Kohler
yes.
are average of a pitch angle.
Yes.
So if you have a beam, say you have a group of particles which are isotropic in a beam system, and then the loss rate goes as little gamma times big gamma squared.
Right.
So you know you can decide which
right.
sort of particle energy you take and how much.
Yeah. So in terms of the angular distribution, I'm not sure we took that account, but in terms
yeah.
of beaming calibration, we have taken that account already, right? For the inverse Compton.
I see. But this is good for. I
yeah.
mean, if Fermi rules out that inverse Compton takes place, right.
We're
still in business.
Yes. Well, there's more than one way to win a battle, yes. I guess we're out of time.
No, I mean, I think we're...
Well, I was just going to ask you to show plot.